Welcome, everybody. And topic today is healing healthcare, the moral and political dimensions of healthcare reform. Too often, the discussion is either about the moral issues around healthcare, or we get lost in the political wheelings and dealings and ins and outs and this bill, that bill, and the other bill, and we all get lost. And so we end up with healthcare reform that doesn't cover everyone and is going to cost even more than we're already spending. So today we're looking to talk to both issues together, because I think that that's because it's the interplay of those two that is really what's going to move us forward. So we're very honored to have Stuart Feiner, who's here representing Jared Polis, and he works with his office. And Reverend Dr. Jim Ryan is executive director for the last 10 years, right, of the Colorado Council of Churches, which has been very active in pursuing issues of social justice, in particular healthcare issues. He's also, well, a long career of doing many things, has recently been on the board of directors of Housing Justice, president of the board of EcoJustice Ministries, and on the board of Samaritan Counseling Center. Also on the front lines of healthcare and a number of different aspects has been Dr. Irene Aguilar, who's been for the last 20 years a primary care provider with the Denver Health and Hospitals Westside Family Health Center. She was a co-chair of the Colorado Blue Ribbons Task Force on Vulnerable Populations that happened over about a year and 2 years ago. And she is president of Healthcare for All Colorado, which is a major organizing and activist group here in Colorado pushing for a single payer financing of our healthcare. So with that, I will turn. We didn't decide who wants to go first, but speakers will talk about 15, 20 minutes each, and then we'll open it up to discussion and let the fun begin.
I was going to let you go first, if that was okay, because I always talk too long.
Do you? Yeah.
And that way it'll cut me off.
And I'm a preacher, and you think that's not going to happen. If you'll, thank you for inviting me, first of all. I appreciate it. This is my second time to be here. I was here a couple years ago, and glad to be back. I'm not sure this was exactly the morning I had envisioned as I said, yes, I'll drive from Denver up to Boulder and be there by 7:30, but there were actually no problems. I was coming up 93, but decided instead, once I saw the weather, to come up 36, and it was wet, but no problems along the way, so it's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me back. If you would think with me for a moment of a rural town in Colorado, you can pick Rifle or you can pick some other rural town in Colorado and imagine a single mother with three small children who's working at the diner in town. Hourly job, not enough to have health care coverage provided. She struggles with between the simply having enough money period, getting to work, getting home in time, being there for the kids, providing child care for them on those times when they have to be off from school and she has to work. And one of the kids wakes up in the morning sick. What is she going to do? To take time off from work, which is always a problem for her boss, means her salary will go down and that she will have less money to spread around to those utilities and the rent and food and whatever it's going to cost to go to the doctor. Plus she has to travel at least an hour and a half to get to a medical provider, and that takes gas. That really is a very difficult issue. She cares deeply about her child who's sick. She also knows that if she doesn't take that child to the doctor, but sends the child to school, your grandchildren are going to be sitting there next to her children, and they will soon be sick. Likely she's going to get sick. And as she coughs and sneezes over your food as you she delivers it to your table at the diner, you're going to get sick. This is not simply a question about what to do about health care. This is a moral issue that we all face, all of us, as well as she does. And as people of faith, we are called to a standard of our faith of caring about our brothers and sisters and loving our neighbors as we love ourselves. A family finds themselves without health care coverage all of a sudden because of a layoff at work. A person has a pre-existing condition and they can no longer have health care. These are moral questions and issues. 800,000 Coloradans do not have coverage. 81% are uninsured, of the uninsured are working families. Premiums have gone up since the year 2000, have gone up 74%, and wages only 15%. 27% of Colorado families spend more than 10% of their income on health care. Statistics show that if a family, particularly lower income, is spending more than 5%, they are taking then away from other essentials of life. Nice to him. So what we hear around this issue, probably the question most often, the Council of Churches does a lot of work around immigration too. The question we hear with immigration always is, what is it about illegal you don't understand? The question we hear most often around healthcare issue is, can we afford it? That's what's it going to cost us to provide health care coverage for all? The afford question is the first question that seems to be asked as if it is a definitive question. But the question of can we afford it is deeper than a financial question. It is truly a question of morals for each of us and for our society as a whole. It has been said recently, I've heard people say, well, 80% of the population of America are quite satisfied with their present health care situation. So the underlying question is, does the 80% care about the 20% who are not satisfied with their present health care situation? It is a moral question. It, in fact, is a question about our morals. Is a different way of stating it. In 1988, President Reagan, as he was running for re-election, asked the question, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Some of us in the room are old enough to remember that campaign. We'll explain it to you later. As a pastor, want to confess that I failed to challenge that question at the time. It was the wrong question, and the church should have spoken up and said, that is the wrong question. The question isn't, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The question should have been asked, are the poor better off than they were 4 years ago? That was the role of the church, to rephrase that question. And we didn't do it. The church has a role today to make sure that as this debate about health care goes on, that the moral aspect of it, the moral question, the question about our morals, is a part of that whole discussion. Society is judged by how it treats those in the dawn of their life, that is the children, those in the twilight of their life, those who are elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, those who often get missed, aren't seen. And it's not that they don't have a voice, it is that their voice is never listened to by those who are in power. We have a responsibility to speak up and to act for those people, for those in the dawn of their life, for those in the twilight of their life, and those in the shadow of their life. People of faith have a responsibility. Our faith calls us to that responsibility. It is a, let me say it clearly, a sin when we remain silent. The Colorado Council of Churches is very clear about who should have health care coverage in this country and who should not. We're very restrictive about that. Only those who are children made in the image of God should have health care coverage in this country. So we have adopted four principles. And I'm going to pass around and we may or may not have enough for everybody that we can share. This was a letter signed by every denominational executive. That's depending on which denomination is, what they are called, a bishop or regional minister or whatever, of the member denominations of the Colorado Council of Churches. That was then determined by their that denominational executive how to send it out to their congregations, how to use it. Every denominational executive signed onto it. It's a pastoral letter to the people of faith, of the Christian faith within Colorado. It talked at the point where it was originally done when there were a lot of town hall meetings going on and the atmosphere was not always the most conducive to human interaction. And so the first part of the letter simply calls for that civil discourse. But then we identified four areas that we felt needed to be a part of it, four principles that need to be part of any healthcare principle. We have not advocated for one answer or another answer, but that these four principles must be included in order to be what we thought, faithful health care coverage for all. The four principles is that it needs to be inclusive, it needs to be affordable, it needs to be accessible, and those are not the same things. Sometimes the cost keeps things from being accessible, but there are other factors, particularly in rural Colorado, where access is not a financial issue. It may be for some, but not for everyone. And it needs to be accountable. We can talk more, I'm gonna quit as soon as I say this part. We can talk more around rural Colorado, the issues around that, the telecommunications aspect of it, simply the availability of providers, those kinds of things that we're, the Council of Churches is beginning to take a much more in-depth look at and begin to try to figure out how to work with local congregations to have an impact in the local setting about having that health care be available. But I want you to have these four principles. We see it very much as a moral issue. These four principles must be a part of any health care solution. And the Denver Post this morning, it was on the internet, aren't we just wonderful, talking about that the three plans presently trying to be brought together in the House are under $900 billion now. Again, back to the cost factor as the most important issue. And I would say that is not the most important issue.
Thank you. I want to apologize because I'm a little bit of a PowerPoint junkie. So I'm going to turn on my PowerPoint. I'm also a food junkie, but I'm working on that one. I
PowerPoint addiction yet. So you can only take one out at a time, you know? And I was smiling as I was listening because I actually have some of your same quotes in my PowerPoint.
Thank you for letting me go first.
But part of what I always like to have the other person go first is that as I mentioned at the webinar, and I can talk for hours if you let me. And so I'm going to work on being concise so that you can now. And I bought my little remote so I could try not to stand right here. Let's see if it works. Nope, it won't work. I have to stand in front of you, sorry. The first slide I had, actually, I think, starts a little bit. I guess I want to start by saying I'm going to propose an hypothesis, and I'm going to try and defend that. My hypothesis is first that, as with the Reverend Ryan, I believe that health care is a basic human right. My second is that I believe that the United States has lost its moral compass. And my third is that I think that it is possible to both do the right thing and be fiscally conservative. United Nations, the Declaration of Human Rights, that was adopted in 1948. And in this declaration, under Article 25, it says that everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. This is a declaration that the United States has signed on to the reasoning of different articles that you can sign on to different articles. And the United States has signed on to this article, and there are some forces that we need to ask the UN to investigate the United States' violation of this basic human right that they've signed on to. This is the one we had that was a saying that's Hubert Humphrey, who said the moral test of our government is how we treat those who are in the dawn of life, those who are in the twilight, and those who are in the shadows of life. So, the reason we have a problem is that what we're trying to do is finance healthcare using an insurance model. An insurance model is something you use where you have a bunch of people come in, put a little bit of money in, on the off chance that something bad happens to one of them. In fact, it started with the ancient Babylonian traders in case one of their good wagons of goods got stolen as they were traveling across the desert. They wouldn't go bankrupt. They all put some money in and they get that money back. And we use this model in the United States successfully, I think, for automobile insurance. Some people choose to use it for disability insurance, and homeowners insurance are other examples. With regard to insurance, again, it's with the possibility that you'll need it. The problem is that everybody needs medical care. There is no possibility you'll need medical care. You need medical care. So now, back in the 1930s when we first adopted this model, maybe that wasn't quite so universally true. Our life expectancy was 59 years old. There were a few things, to be honest, that doctors could do that were worth paying for. And I would argue that there are still some things that doctors could do that were not worth paying for. But as medicine has evolved, and we get to 2008, or even I think 2008, because that's what I last know the life expectancy for, the average life expectancy was up to 77.7 years. And I think you can argue that you need medical care when you're a twinkle in your mother's eye. Your mother should be taking that folic acid, not smoking, not drinking, and starting to think about creating a safe environment for growing you. And in the United States today, at least, many people die in medical care, either in the hospital with an acute illness or having been diagnosed with something, treated for something, and then in hospice at home. And so, my first argument is that insurance is the wrong model for financing medical care. It's not a question of if you might need it, it's you need it, how are we going to pay for it? And I was going to go through the history of health insurance, but I think I want to talk just about a couple of things. One of the other fundamental errors we have is that our health insurance is tied to our employment. And that model worked really well back in the day in which it came up. You know, in World War II, part of the way this happened was that in World War II, there weren't enough employees out there, and employers were competing against the few men and women that were left to work in their markets, and the government put a freeze on wages. But they did not freeze the ability to give your employees benefits. So being sneaky, they started, corporations with money started offering benefits to people to get them to come and work for their company. And it worked out really well for the worker. And then the government sort of ended up cementing this relationship by, in 1954, making that a tax-free benefit. So people who work for large corporations get this benefit of health insurance and don't pay any taxes on any of that money that's spent. And let me tell you, I work half-time as a physician at Denver Health. I'm employed by the City and County of Denver. My health insurance premium costs $23,000 a year for me and my family. I get that $23,000 paid for without paying taxes on any of that money, even though I'm in the highest income tax bracket in the country. Now, the woman who works next to me in the clinic, who maybe makes $23,000 a year, costs her $23,000 a year for health insurance as well. And it's so in addition to the fact that it's a regressive benefit, I get a much better benefit in my taxes than she does, is the fact that I can afford to pay that, and she can't. But when employment and health insurance got tied together, there were so many healthy employed people in this market that there was extra money left behind, and for-profit insurers entered this. Now, the legal duty of a for-profit company is to make a profit. And so even though it annoys me that they make profits, that is their legal duty, and they're doing what they're bound to do by law. Unfortunately, they're really good at it. And as you can see, these are some of the Fortune magazine listed profits in pharmaceuticals, insurers, hospitals, distributors, and this is the drug company. And I always like to say that if you're not going to really reform healthcare, you need to invest in pharmaceutical companies because they do really good for their profit holders. Yellow is what the median Fortune 500 does. Red is what drug companies do. So you see, they do much better than the median companies. Mm-hmm. And this is recession proof. This is from the Wall Street Journal in 2009. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 6%, healthcare was 7%, but insurance was 19%. And if we enact this insurance mandate coming up, you might want to invest in insurance right now because I bet that'll go up. Medical equipment providers are 21%. Pharmaceuticals were down to 1%. Biotechnology, 3%. Now, if you're a company out to make a profit, how do you make a profit? You bring in more money than you put out. And how do you do that in healthcare? You try and bring in people who are healthy and who don't need you to pay for their health care. And so that was, we like to call that cherry picking and lemon dropping. Lemon dropping is when somebody gets sick and suddenly you don't want to offer them that policy anymore. And so that was how experience rating came into being. It was part of a segue from the introduction of a for-profit market into health care. And so what happened was this led to populations who couldn't find insurance. And the federal government intervened at that time because the elderly could not find health insurance. And poor people could find it, but they couldn't afford it. And so in 1965, Medicare was enacted. Medicare is a single-payer program. Everybody pays taxes into this system that then pays for their medical costs. The only people eligible to participate are the elderly and the disabled. Now, why was it the elderly and disabled couldn't find insurance in the private market?
Because they were sick. Elderly and disabled.
They're the people most likely to die. And so nobody wanted to take the risk that they would need medical care. And then Medicaid was started, as I said, just for people who couldn't afford it. I want to interject one point here for you to know about Medicaid. Medicaid is funded by both the federal and the state government. Because of that, each state can decide how they determine Medicaid, who gets in, who doesn't get it. There are some, like, things that nobody can choose to do or not. The federal government does set sort of a floor, but a state can decide how much they're willing to do. And I can tell you that Colorado ranking 49 out of 50 in tax rate, it ranks 49 out of 50 in Medicaid benefits and richness of Medicaid benefits. And in fact, it doesn't matter how poor you are. In Colorado, you never qualify for Medicaid if you don't have children. So my patients who have been on Medicaid all their lives, and now their last child turns 19, is dropped from Medicaid because they are no longer the parent of a child. So the first time when this was happening in the United States, the government did step in. They said, look, we have populations who can't get insurance. we're going to rescue them, and they created Medicare and Medicaid. Unfortunately, as time went on, as there was progress in medicine, as business practices got perhaps more deceptive and unfair, we're back at that situation again. We're now in the United States, as the Reverend mentioned, there are 46 million people who can't get health insurance. And as the Reverend mentioned, there 800,000 of them are in Colorado. That number was up to 880,000 earlier this year, or 17% of our population. So almost one out of five people have no health insurance in the state of Colorado. And this is just in 2007 what the insurance status looks like. If you were to take 100 people, 57 of them would have health insurance from their employer in some way, 9 from Medicaid, 9 from Medicare, 17%, as we mentioned, uninsured. SCHIP is a program for children, individual or private individual policies. 4% is other, that's like the VA or Indian Health Services. This is about our losing our moral thing. This is a website I like, it's themoralcompass.org. George Matafanoff says that the adoption of free market economics globally is increasingly placing the market at the center of society. As a result, the influence it exerts on our lives extends far wider than market transactions, often superseding family, community, church, society, and even democratically elected governments. The market, for all intents and purposes, has become the market with a capital S. And I think this is what's happened, unfortunately, in the United States. It's never a question of, is this right? It's, well, it's free will, this is what the United States was founded on, mm-hmm. You know, you pull yourself up by the bootstraps, as the president says, if you have no boots, go find some. and unfortunately, this is what's happened, and we've lost our concept of the common good, and I think healthcare should be a common good. As Aaron mentioned, most people who are uninsured are workers, 70% of them in 2007, his number may be correct for now. Either in the workforce or are dependents of people in the workforce. And why don't the workers have health insurance? It's really expensive. The new numbers just released by the Kaiser Foundation show that it's now over $13,000 on average for an employer-sponsored family policy. Now, if you are self-employed, you have to pay that like after tax dollars. You don't get that same tax benefit. And so those individual policies cost you even more. The median income in 2006 was $52,275. In 2008, it's down, actually, $50,303. So do we think it's fair to expect these people to make $50,000 a year to be able to pay $13,000 just for the insurance policy? That's not copay. That's not deductible. That's not uncovered services. And those of you working in mental health knows that means mostly that's not mental health. So what's happened is that the market has come into play again with healthcare because there are benefits to be made in having this insurance industry because people can pay for health insurance pre-tax. You'll see people, you know, clinging to this benefit, and that's the unions, and I believe in unions and advocating for the hard workers and stuff, but unfortunately they work so hard to get the health benefits they have. They're really afraid to let them go. And financially, it's a huge boon for them to be able to get that those policies I mentioned, like with the city, the $24,000 a year for my family, the city actually pays 80% of that before I ever see it. Now, is it really the city paying it? Well, no, because that's why wages have only gone up, what did you say, 5%, and health benefits have gone up, you know, 30%. So we forget that sometimes. And the other thing we forget is that because we put our money into the tax system, all of these outliers, the high-risk pool of Medicare, the poor, we're paying for as well through our taxes. And so this has become the primary mechanism of paying for healthcare, but it's really very costly, complex, and distorted. And this is the premise on which this slide right here shows you the basis for single-payer health care. This is just showing from between 1970 and 2007 of the growth that we've seen in physicians, and that's that tiny little yellow line on the bottom, and administrators, and that's that blue line on the top. And what I like to say is that this is what we do to be sure that I don't spend $10 more for you than I think you deserve, than you've somehow crossed some rule to entitle yourself to. And my concern about this is that if any of you have the stamina to read even a 20-page summary of the bills that are being considered in Congress right now, I would, my vision of this slide after Congress enacts the kind of health care reform they're talking about is that blue light. Ever see Al Gore with An Inconvenient Truth, how he gets on that thing and goes way up to the ceiling? That's what's going to happen with that blue light. Because in order to determine whether your company has less than 40 employees, pays on average less than $40,000 per person in payroll, whether your family's income for a family of 2, 3, 4, or 5 is at 3 or 4 or 500% of federal poverty level, that takes administration. And that administration eats up money. And today in the United States, it eats up 30 cents of every dollar. And so because of that, our costs are outrageous in the United States compared to every other country in the world. So
managed care. That was a cost saving.
Managed care, I think, started a little before that.
In the 80s.
But that's when it became popular. Right now it's 95% of managers.
Really?
Of the people we have.
Oh, okay. And so we get our outrageous spending amounts, which I wanted to say, you'll notice, mimic the life expectancy. I mean, in 70 people lived to be maybe 67, and now we're in 2009, you live to be, you know, 77. From 65 on, who's insuring you? Federal government. So we have this huge risk pool that we're spending money on to ensure that our healthcare spending is going up along with that. But the fact that we have that administrative overhead, I think, is largely what contributes to this disparity that you see here. This is how much the United States on the far left spends on healthcare compared to all the other industrialized countries, compared to these that are listed in specific. But what's important to know is in all of the other countries, healthcare is a right. And they have non-for-profit insurers, if they have insurers at all, or they have government-run and sponsored healthcare. And as you see, the red line is how much the government or public pays for healthcare. And if you were to add into there the approximately $300 billion that we give as tax subsidies to the corporations who give employer-sponsored care, the U.S. as a government alone spends more than all the other countries, even before you put in private spending on healthcare.
Irene, what are the different colors represented?
So red is government spending, green is private spending, and orange is out-of-pocket spending.
What is private spending?
Private spending is like what your employer is spending.
Oh.
And that's why I said in the green number, you can take about a third of that, because that's a tax break that the employer and you have gotten. And so in some respects, that's what the government is giving up in taxes by allowing you to pay for the three tax dollars. Colorado in 2007 was estimated to spend $30.1 billion on health care, just the state of Colorado. Now, of the money that's spent, 41% of that comes from employers and workers. Remember, they were 57% of the population has that type of insurance. They actually only end up covering 41% of the cost because they usually have healthier people in their pocket. But the government ends up paying 19% with Medicare, 2% Champus, 10% Medicaid, 2% other public. So really, another 40% is paid for already by the federal government and the state government. Now, the reason I said that we spend that much more than those other countries because we don't guarantee health care and have single-payer health care is because when I was on that 208 commission, I have to admit I was very naive about health care financing because I worked for Denver Health and I got a paycheck every 2 weeks. I had no idea. People could come in to see me. I had no idea what they had done to get there, who they were paying, what they were paying. I just got a paycheck. And then Medicare D came into being, and I started to get some sense of what exists out there in the private insurance market. And then I was on the 208 Commission. And on the 208 Commission, they said to us as a task force, here are four proposals. Analyze these proposals and tell us what you think the benefits and what you think the negative points are on these proposals for the population you represent. And I represented vulnerable populations. And as a group, what we said was, you know, ultimately, everybody is vulnerable because right now, your insurance is tied to your employment. And if, God forbid, something happened and you get that catastrophic disease so that you can no longer work or you're in an accident, you lose your health insurance. So what you're looking at is what works best for everybody. And this is when I first really learned about what single-payer health care was. The concept of single-payer is that everybody needs health care, so everybody should pay for health care. but not everybody has the same ability to pay. And so you should pay for it based on what we call a sliding scale premium, which is the same as a tax. So your tax is based on your income. And if you make more, you know, everybody pays, say, 5%. And if you make more, that happens to be more money. If you make less, it happens to be less money. If you make really less, then maybe you don't pay anything at all. And so when they did the analysis on the different proposals, the Vulnerable Populations Task Force looked at this and said, we need to enact this program here because everybody would be covered. The first thing that the Reverend Ryan had said was that it's important that it be inclusive, that everybody be covered. And this was the only proposal that covered every single person living in Colorado. And so that was the first reason we picked it. The second reason we picked it is that you could do that and spend $1.4 billion less than you were spending right now. So what I'm saying is that you could go from having 17% of the population with no insurance, 28% of the population, as the Reverend mentioned, with under insurance, to having 100% of the population with comprehensive benefits. And the pricing on this included mental health parity 100%. It included substance abuse treatment. It included dental care. The co-payments were $5 or $10 for everything, including prescription drugs, medical equipment, nursing home care. And I looked at this and thought, well, that's what the commission is going to pick. And as the report came out, I learned how naive I was. And in fact, the day that the commission made their presentation to the legislature, I sat right behind the two people who were presenting because they weren't even going to say this as a fact. Because what they said to me is, this is not politically viable.
Oh.
And I said, why not? And they said, well, it's not politically viable because the federal government has this law called ERISA, and the state does not regulate large corporations and their ability to insure. And I said, but isn't the federal government there to protect the people? And if that doesn't help the people, couldn't we do something about that? And I said, well, it's not politically viable because it's not the way we've done it. It's not an American value. And I have been working since then to try and find someone who would have the courage to say, it may not be politically viable, but it's the right thing to do. And I will tell you how disappointing it is in talking to people one by one by one and having them say, yes, I know single payer is the best answer, but.
Irene, are you going to say something about where that cost saving comes from? Is it primarily reduced administrative costs?
Or? Yeah, 30% of it is administrative. Yeah. The other thing that's in there is actually bargaining for pharmaceutical prices.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many of you know this, but when Medicare D came into being, initially the pharmaceutical companies were fighting it because the federal government would have bargained for the prices of the drugs. And so the bill was amended to not allow the federal government to bargain for prices of pharmaceuticals for senior patients. The result was, and I need to look up this number, but it was trillions of dollars in profit to the insurance industry. And so, you know, sometimes when people will say, well, you know, we can't afford this, and well, we couldn't afford all that profit we gave the pharmaceutical company either, but we did it. But anyway, so that's the other place. It's 30% administrative reduction, and I think it was like 15% pharmaceutical cost reductions. And then I have a breakout somewhere. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it was not through decreasing services. In fact, services increased. And there was a number in there that count offset that savings because of increasing access and also taking into account that people who have not had health care for years will use more health care at the start. So how do we know it can be done? Every other industrialized nation in the world does it. They all spend less than we do. Many spend less than half. And they have better death rates, more accountability, and higher satisfaction. I know you might have heard this, but the United States ranks 37th in their healthcare system. And what I'm told is that one of the values they rank you on is how much you spend. That if you were to take away spending, we would rank 75th. As part as quality of healthcare system based on access, affordability, outcomes. We have some powerful opponents. The insurance companies obviously would lose business and profit. Pharmaceutical companies would lose profit. Many providers are really afraid. They look right now at that Medicare payment rate, which is about 70% of what a private insurer pays, and they say, I can't make it on 70% of, you know, if everybody paid me this amount, I couldn't make a go of it. But if, but what they forget is, and there was an article this summer in Health Affairs that said that for one physician, it costs $68,000 in administrative costs for them to collect their money. So my thought is that, you know, if your rate went from 100 to 70, but you didn't have to pay $68,000 a year to get that money, that you probably would be okay. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that what I showed you was the dream. You know, everybody gets everything for $5 or $10, and you have dental, mental health, whatever. I mean, they could start modifying that. You say you only get this, you only get that, but we would still be leaps ahead of where we are right now. Many small businesses right now that don't pay anything at all would be forced to contribute, and the insured are afraid of getting less coverage and more costs and big government. You know, when I hear that statistic that 80% of people are happy with their health insurance, my pat response is that's because they're healthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
But they've not had to go and fight their insurer for anything yet. And once they come down with a catastrophic illness, or even just a serious illness, they'll realize what the limitations are of their policy. I had no idea, even that there were, that insurance companies have limits on policies, I'm embarrassed to say, until I was on that commission. The first thing I did was I went home and looked at our policy, like, oh, thank God, we don't have any limits. But this is the first year the City and County of Denver, the only non-HMO option they're offering, has limits, and this is the first year that's happened for the city and county because they usually have a really robust insurance plan. So it's getting out of price even for the people who spend the most money on health insurance. And obviously the insured feel a fear of big government. We have somehow managed to take government from being something that's there to protect us, to ensure our civil liberties, to ensure our ability to pursue life, liberty, and happiness as something that's there to take our money. And I'm not sure how that happened. What someone said to me once, our taxes are what make us different from Zaire. And so we need to work on that as a separate issue. There are a lot of people who would support it, obviously the uninsured, the elderly, and middle class, because it's those of you who know people on Medicare right now, they have a hard time finding doctors willing to take them. Medicaid and Medicare recipients for choice, big business, because it would ultimately control their costs, especially those who have made promises for retirement that they can't keep anymore. Healthcare providers and employees could begin to bargain for salary increases instead of just benefits. Our president said, and I have this down and I have it in writing from the quoted from his speech, he says, I want to cover everybody. And then he said, the truth is that unless you have what's called a single-payer system in which everybody's automatically covered, then you're probably not going to reach every single individual. And even the most robust plan that they're considering right now, which is HR 3200, would still leave 17 million people without access to health care. And Martin Luther King, I'm looking for this person that Martin Luther King is talking about still, and if you know a politician who is this person, please send them to me. I will work hard for them. He says, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but one must take it simply because it is right. And I would love to see a politician out there saying, to everyone, this is wrong. The president has said it. We can provide coverage for everybody. If we go to a single-payer system, it's the right thing to do. We need to figure out how to do it. Now, single-payer part two, I can tell you how you can do a single-payer system and have market forces in it. I can tell you how you can do a single-payer system and allow and control costs. I mean, there are ways to do that. All single-payer means is that everybody pays a portion of their income for health care. How that gets administrated and distributed is a whole different lecture. And so that's the end of my topic.
So you can change now to any questions, thoughts, comments?
Yeah, you know. Arizona has a very, very conservative state. However, my daughter, who's currently a student at Penn State, very poor, has their state insurance, pays $1 for anything. They have Mohs surgery. It's very expensive. $1. $1 for every prescription. That is their insurance for people who are poor. That's, I mean, statewide. So what's the deal here?
And you know,
I think so.
I think that somehow we have made this into a political party issue. Because really, the conservatives are the party of valuing human life. They are the party of believing in being viewed as being more Christian. And certainly, Christ would say that everybody should have health care. But I think somehow it became, because it got tied with unions and health benefits, it became a democratic liberal issue. And I think the first thing we need everybody to do is go back to the moral issue, to the human rights issue, to how do we value life issues. And it may just be that Arizona is there more than other people are, that someone in their government has said, this is a basic human right and we're going to pay for it.
Irene, would you come back up here, Irene?
Mm-hmm. Another hot button that's been in some of the discussion is that matter of the immigrants, the illegals kind of thing. And in terms of faith values, it's interesting that Leviticus 19, the same section of Leviticus that has the stuff about sexuality and whatnot, says that the alien among you is to be treated exactly as the citizen. There is to be no distinction, which would seem to me to have a little weight with some of the people who object to the alien.
We, the Council of Churches representatives, met with several of our congressional representative staff this August, and we talked about two issues, immigration and health care. It was clear that even the president said repeatedly, those who are not here, who are not documented, are not going to be covered. And it was one of those issues where we came up with a statement that I used earlier, saying that we only think people who are made in the image of God should have health care coverage.
Does that make those Republicans? It does.
Because God is sort of in the image of God.
Just kidding.
Yeah, I know. But that's a point that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And so it has become politicized, as you were indicating. One of the elders in the church I used to serve before I retired as a pastor, and I was used to do two jobs, now I'm only doing one. It's kind of nice. I like it. He said to me, after we were talking about including people and things, and Jesus kept doing that. This Jesus guy causes us all kinds of problems. He said, well, God helps those who help themselves. And I said, you know, Don, I've heard that all my life. I just never heard Jesus say it. It seems to me Jesus says, God helps those who are in the business of helping other people. So I would agree, but...
That whole immigrant thing, it's so interesting because we will, of course, cover illegal immigrants.
Yes.
We do now, and we'll continue to.
Right. Just more expensive
way. We do now. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that objection.
Right.
You know, because, you know, they show up at the emergency room, right. They're covered. I mean, they're going to get treatment.
Mm-hmm. But not at the... Yeah, not in the same way as they could. I mean, no, I understand your point, but they could be get even better for less money.
Barry? Healthcare for All Colorado sent me to Washington in July for a rally, and I met a lot of the health specialists in Congress, but the image I brought back that's strongest in my mind was a woman in the audience on the green with a sign that said, who would Jesus not cure because of pre-existing conditions? And that's the kind of image somehow we need to get across. Yeah. Not just the words, but images like that. It might be an infant child or whatever, but the image is really important.
The other thing I've heard, and again, I need to memorize these stats. I have too many things to still memorize, but is that if you were to look at what undocumented people bring into our tax system versus what they take out, it's actually a net gain to us right now because they're not entitled to number the benefits they're paying for. When they use a fake Social Security number, all that money is being taken out, and they have no hopes of ever getting it back.
Bill?
People keep talking about how we can't afford all this. But the truth is, we're paying for it anyway. If you come to the hospital, they have to take it. And they have to charge somebody. If the person who comes has no insurance, then the person who has insurance is going to pay a little more.
Mm-hmm. And the estimate for
we're paying for it anyway. Yeah. The hospital can't provide service without charging.
Mm-hmm. The estimate from 2007 was that $1,000 of each private premium went toward cost shifting or paying for things that weren't being paid for in another way. So you're correct, we do pay for it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Can you comment on the Massachusetts system and how, what you know of that and its success or not? I did hear Governor Romney talk about it. Everyone says they're losing money. It's not working, but he basically said, we're not losing money. We have 6 to 8% loss that we expected, especially in the beginning, in the first part of the process, and that in fact it's working really well. I don't know that much about it. I do know that it's a state that has everyone insured.
The Massachusetts requires everyone to purchase, just like car insurance. You're required to have car insurance, you're required to have health care. They have different levels of income of what you can afford. They set where the subsidies started. They set it too high. A group of interfaith group in Boston did a study to find out what the actual affordability was. They were then able to lower that affordability where the subsidies start. So here in Colorado, the Council of Churches partnered with a couple other organizations to do an affordability study here. We did over 100 sites across Colorado, interviewing people with their full financial records, histories, so on, to do an affordability study. And what I said earlier about if a family is paying over 5% towards healthcare costs, then they are, particularly for poorer families, they are starting to subtract from the essentials, not discretionary income, but from the essentials of their life. That affordability study is available online. If you'll go to the www.cochurches.org, there's a link that goes to that affordability study here in Colorado.
I have a question. I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, but I see in the paper the cost of the plans that are being considered in Congress, you know, $871 billion, whatever it is. Now, when one reads that, one has the assumption, and maybe this is true, that that's beyond what is currently being spent on health care. And I'm wondering about how what is currently being spent for health insurance premiums gets factored into that. Is that really a totally additional cost, or can you?
Yeah, that goes in with the line of if you like what you have, you keep it. Mm-hmm. So there's no expectation that what we pay right now would change. What would change is that there would be a new product available out there for people who are currently in the individual market or uninsured that they could then purchase. Because nothing is done to change the way that
which makes this
that healthcare is administered or practiced.
It's have to be.
Expensive, yeah. Right. And yes. The way in which they're keeping the cost down at $871 billion are, first of all, they anticipate savings from Medicare because they're going to eliminate a lot of the extra payments that are being made to the Medicare Advantage plan. They talk about finding fraud and abuse and saving money that way. That's all I think they have in the savings part right now. The other thing, in answer to your question, is that it depends on who you talk to whether or not Massachusetts is working. Mm-hmm. What has happened is that the state is running out of money, and so what they're doing is they're cutting their support to their safety net. And so three of their community health centers have closed, and two of their public hospitals have closed because they don't have enough financing. And so I think those people who are undocumented are probably suffering more in Massachusetts. The other thing is that everybody has health insurance, but if co-pays and deductibles are high, they still don't have access to health care. Now, the way to keep insurance costs down is to make you pay more out of pocket up front. And there are good research studies that show that when people have to pay more out of pocket up front, they defer their care, or they don't do what's recommended because they can't afford to do it. So, and the absolute number of how many people have health insurance, Massachusetts is leading. Whether they have access to health care is something you'll hear dispute about.
They're also excluding now legal migrants, legal aliens, not illegal, but illegal ones from health care coverage. Is that correct?
I don't know, actually.
I did read that.
So I'm a little confused here, and I want to also bring Stuart into the conversation as well in representing Jared Polis and our government side of things. If the whole discussion is around economics and affordability, and the costs are so high for any of the bills that are on the table, and single payer is the most affordable one, how come it gets dismissed so easily? I don't quite understand the logic there. If that's the main
logic.
Wait, let me go on record as saying that Representative Polis is the only congressional delegate we have who has signed on to H.R. 676, which is the national single payer bill.
Yes.
He is on the Rules Committee that will be looking at what amendments are kept as the bills in the House are being finalized. And one of the amendments on the House bill is something called the Kucinich Amendment. And I forgot to ask you all to write to everybody and ask them to endorse this amendment. What the Kucinich Amendment does is it gives states an exemption to ERISA so they could pilot innovative programs, including a single-payer plan, at a state level. And in Canada, single-payer began in one province. And it was so financially successful that the other provinces adopted it. And so those of us who are strong single-payer advocates are saying, HCAC has always said this, but all the other people are now saying that it's going to have to start at one state. There's just too many politics at a big level. If we could get it in one state, if we could really show that it is possible and affordable and that the sky doesn't fall, then maybe the rest of the country would get it. So go ahead.
That's exactly what I was getting.
But he was asking more about why doesn't it go anywhere otherwise in Congress.
Well, you said it actually in your beautiful PowerPoint presentation. The political will is not there to pass a single payer system at this point. The votes aren't there. I don't know why. Well,
you can guess.
Speculate.
I could speculate that some people, members of Congress, get some of their financing maybe from the insurance. did you say you're audio taping?
Yes.
But I think Common Cause has said that the health insurance and pharmaceutical industry are spending $1.4 million a day on lobbyists against health care reform. And I read some stat, and I can't remember what it said. Is it like 40 to 1 they have lobbyists that are there to lobby the Congress and senators against doing anything like this?
I would also add that from Jared's perspective, obviously single payer is the way to go, and he does support it, and he's always supported it. And, you know, would hope that that would be the result. But he also agrees that without campaign finance reform and comprehensive immigration reform, health care reform or health insurance reform is always going to be limited. And so we hear different things from callers. You know, the 2nd District of Colorado is a pretty amazing district, and we're very lucky here. People are pretty very educated, pretty informed, pretty reasonable. There's a lot of support for single payer. There's a lot of support for the president's health care reform. We got a lot of calls about that. Please support the president's health care reform, including the public option. A lot of support for the public option. And at the same time, there's a lot of fear, as you pointed out. You know, the opposition does a really, really good job at presenting a fear-based response to this whole argument, this whole debate, this whole effort. The thing about big government, and if anybody saw the Nine News healthcare town hall the other day, it was at the Anschutz Medical Center, and then it was on TV on Saturday night. There were six representatives of the Colorado delegation. Only Representative Kaufman represented the Republicans. And you know, all you have to do is say free market, liberty, freedom, and the you know, half the audience goes nuts. And so there's a lot of fear around acknowledging that America is not number one in every possible thing. And you know, I think at the beginning of this, a few months ago, I would have thought, and I, you know, I could guess maybe the president thought so too when he made a quote like that in July. If we just explain this clearly enough, people will get it. But and then there came a time where I thought we're not doing a good enough job explaining this. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a contingency of people who will just not believe you. They say, you're a lot. I mean, we heard it on the floor of the Congress. And we heard it. I heard it the other day. Yeah. This woman was standing right near us, not near the stage, but in the back of the auditorium. And, you know, she kept saying, liar. I mean, she didn't say it loud enough for the people on the stage here, only to annoy the people around her. But, you know, everything was a lie. And there's this fear, this big government fear. And it's very hard to combat that because it's a simple refusal to believe you. I mean, I don't believe you. So, and that's a very strong component of this. I don't think it's as nearly as big as the support for healthcare reform, and it's
always. I think there are closet supporters too who don't want to.
I think so too. Just like they're probably closet supporters of Obama, but there's a lot of fear about the illegals. Everything now is the illegals. I think one of the differences with the aliens in Leviticus is they generally look like everybody else in the area at the time, and that's generally not true with the illegals people are afraid of right now. And Jared's a big supporter of comprehensive immigration reform, and even said to someone at one of our events at the Boulder Farmers Market, who was arguing this is going to cover illegals, and he's like, it's not going to cover illegals. I wish it did. Mm-hmm. Which was a pretty risky thing for him to say. Mm-hmm. But that's the situation. I'm pretty hopeful, even though I'm a little depressed after your presentation. I'm still pretty hopeful we're going to pass something, and I know the congressman is hopeful we're going to pass something. And if it's not single payer now, and people are afraid that this is it. What's the word they use? Not Trojan horse, but
slippery slope.
Slippery slope.
Slippery slope, or switching.
They are messaging. You guys all know the message.
All these things to a single payer system, and in that respect, I think we still aren't giving a good enough message on what that really means. And to Jared's credit, not that I have to credit him, but he always says at any event, we do have a single payer system, it's Medicare. We do have socialized medicine, mm-hmm. which is a VA, and I'm not sure it's going in. I'm not sure people are.
If I could add medicine that the representatives and senators get, isn't that socialized?
If I could add one thing.
No, because we get the same as everybody. Every federal employee has the same. It's more like the exchange they talk about. What it does is, you know, I understand that if you're wherever you live regionally, you're limited to the number of policies you can choose from. When I was choosing my policy, the truth is they say, you know, you could choose from anything. That's actually was overwhelming to have that many choices. It sort of is like what the exchange would be, where you could choose plans from that are offered across the country instead of just what's in your region. But it's not socialized because I have Aetna, and so the government isn't paying that, you know, doesn't, it's not like the VA where the government owns the hospitals and pays the providers. It's more like a single payer.
I think we fall into a trap, and Stuart helped us a little bit out of that trap, but we all sat here and giggled and laughed when we started talking about politicians and the money, lobbyist money that comes from the pharmaceuticals and from the insurance companies. And it is real easy for us in a group like this to blame the politicians' fear of not being elected and the influence of the money, when the greater influence is the people and the attitudes that get brought and in those meetings and the messages that get sent to the congressional people and the fears that we buy into in our own lives. And I know I'm not just talking about us, but the whole population. If there was a groundswell for healthcare reform among a vast majority of people who were making the phone calls to the congressional people, then the pharmaceuticals could contribute all the money they want. The lawyers would know, the politicians would know, I can get elected because I'm doing what everybody wants me to do. Mm-hmm. So before we laugh at them and their being able to be persuaded by money, we need to look at us, that is all of us. I've been in the ministry 35 years. I still walk into a pulpit knowing sin still exists. I have not cured it in the 35 years of my preaching, and I know it best because I know the person standing in the pulpit. There is still sin. So we have faults, and we need to recognize that all of us worry about ourselves first. And if I got good coverage, then I guess I can worry about some others. And don't just blame it on politicians and the pharmaceuticals and all those folks. It's easy to put the blame over there and not accept our own blame of getting the message out to people who need to hear it.
Lynn?
Yeah, this is a question for you, Stuart. Building on what you just said, what kind of groundswell would it take? What do you need from the public to make a difference? And the second small question is, because we appreciate so much what Jared Polis is doing and the stands he takes, does he still need phone calls from us to bolster something, or should we be putting our phone calls into other people? But that's a minor question. The big question is, what kind of groundswell, what do we need to be doing to make this happen?
Well, in terms of people who are in our district, you're pretty well covered on the House of Representatives side. I think you're in pretty good shape. I think Colorado's in pretty good shape on the Senate side. But if you're in our...
Depends on what you want.
Right, that's true. But I mean, you know, in terms of if you're in our district, I would call your senator. If you're in my district, if you're in Jared's district, I would call your senators. If you're outside of Jared's district and you're in Mike Kaufman's district or Doug Lamport's district, I would call them. I'm not sure how much good it'll do, but at least it gets the message across. We're in pretty good shape. I mean, Jared's going to vote the right way. He is on the Rules Committee.
Where do Udall and Bennett fit?
Well, they both, I think, have come out in support of a public option.
Public option.
That's really great.
Well, we don't have that in a public option, and they're very weak.
Right. Well, I mean, remember that my understanding is that the combined House bill is going to be stronger even than the ones that are presented, so that there's more leverage when the Senate bill is combined and they have to meet. So that's very positive. How that all plays out, I don't know. I mean, it's complicated.
But what kind of groundswell? You need demonstrations, you need
Well, at this point,
you need outrage. What do we need to do?
She wants to
I'm not looking at that. Does she need to be picketing people's houses?
Sit-ins.
At this point, I would contact friends, people you know in other states, other districts, just to get their representatives reassured who do support this, and I think it is the majority. I mean, we're confident something will pass in the House that includes a good public option, and that's a really good step towards something ideal eventually. So you want to contact people in other states, other districts. Because if you, honestly, if you call somebody out of your district, it's not really that useful.
Because you're not a constituent.
You're not a constituent. Yeah. It's just not useful. Mm-hmm. But if you know people, yeah, have them do it.
Mm-hmm. Do the three of you see some addressing of the moral issue of such disparity between the United States and other countries being addressed during this time, and some change just gradually taking place where people understand the common good rather than the individual so mm-hmm. strongly? Do you see any hopefulness for the basic and root questions out of this whole debate? Some development?
I think there's been some movement toward it. The vast majority, a good part of our discussion today has been around money, which for me is not the issue. It is the moral issue of covering all human beings. Mm-hmm. But I think there's been some movement toward it. The immigration issue is the same kind of thing. What the Council of Churches tried to do with a video DVD curriculum that we produced and sent to every one of our congregations across the state of our member denominations for free was around making sure that you're viewing that issue through your faith lens, not just your citizen's hat, but your faith. What does it truly mean to love my neighbor? And Jesus kept talking about that. If you're going to call yourself Christian, if you're going to sit in a pew, then you ought to at least look at that issue of raids through the lens of what does it mean to love my neighbor. So we looked at those issues. I'll tell this one story. We visited several of the congressional representative staff. One of them was Representative Kaufman, recognizing that the congressman was not going to agree with our positions on either immigration or health care, but he needed to hear what the Council of Churches had to say. So as we visited with the two staff members, the woman in charge of the, again, on immigration and health care, but trying to tie them together, the woman who's his staff person in Colorado for immigration, when I started talking about immigration, we're concerned about the treatment of all human beings, she said, "What do you do about the murders and the rapists?" And I said, "What do you?" She said, "Well, immigrants. Murders and rapists, it's all the same." And I said, this conversation is not going to go well, I can tell. One of our staff people said, as we left, said, "I feel like I need a shower." Mm. So there is that mentality out there that we've not got the moral issue across yet. Mm-hmm. But we keep trying, and we keep trying to talk to our people. For the churches, there are people sitting in the pew. Sometimes the church has to speak to all society. Sometimes the church has to speak to the church. Because it's people sitting in the pews who are a selfish, self-centered, non-faith perspective as anybody else in society. So we're keeping to try to do that within the structure of the faith community.
I think one of the other issues is of a moral nature is the integration of these issues. I mean, one of the things that the radical right has done since its inception is, well, we don't want to talk about health care, so we'll talk about immigration. We don't want to talk about immigration, so we'll talk about health care. I was a lobbyist for the Methodist Church from 84 to 88 on health care reform and legalized gambling. And we were trying to tie those two things together on issues of that. And the target population on health care reform were legal migrant workers. That's what they went out after in that time, was to try to take down the Texas Migrant Council and all the groups. Now it's ACORN. And so, to find who the other is and go after them in this way, I think the moral issue is to pull those issues together in such a way that we do have to care for both populations. And My daughter's been sick twice now on her overseas studies with the University of Denver and had zero out-of-pocket cost in Morocco, wonderful health care, and in Sarajevo. And when she's in the United States, that same care cost me $5,800. So it's cheaper for me to pay for her to go to the University of Denver and send her out of country to get health care than it is to have her cared for in this country and get excellent health care.
She may remind you.
I actually want to make a couple of comments. You know, the Presbyterians nationally actually have endorsed single-payer health care, and they had a grant to have organizations do education at state levels. I could not find a Presbyterian church willing to host a conference on single-payer health care with Healthcare for All Colorado. And I thought that was, that just appalled me.
Did they
they didn't ask Stan.
They said they don't believe in single-payer health care. And actually I wanted to present to the Council on Churches on single-payer health care, and they said they've heard it, they won't endorse a specific idea. And so I find, I mean, I was religious when I grew up. I was active in a Baptist church, and I left it, and I like to think of myself now just as a moral person, and I think it's the hypocrisy in religion that really gets me. My son has a bumper sticker from Gandhi that says, "I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. They are so unlike your Christ." And I think that religion is often used as a way of discriminating and harming people in other countries, and we find fault with that. But we don't look at how in our own country it can still be just as closed-minded sometimes. And I found that sad. One of the handouts has on the back, you talked about the moral issue and stuff. The bottom is statistics on income and insurance in race and ethnicity. It gives you different populations from the Commonwealth Health Fund. There is an article, and I don't have it here. It was from the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is one of the well-respected primary care journals, that looked at health disparities, racial and ethnic disparities, in people under age 65 and over age 65. Now, why would they pick 65?
Medicare.
Right. Mm-hmm. The gap narrowed, like 40%. So there is indirect evidence that providing people access to health care decreases racial and ethnic disparity. And it's out there in medical literature. And so that's all I wanted to say.
So thank you very much all for being here. Jim and Irene and Stuart, thank you for being here. Wonderful presentation. And,